Welcome back to Technicast, a podcast by Technica Editorial Services for scholarly publishers, authors, and researchers. Your source for industry news, best practices, and interviews. Today we have another roundtable discussion featuring myself, Nathan Taylor, Chris Moffitt, Hayes Simpson, and Grace Taylor. We all recently attended the Council for Scientific Editors virtual conference that happened earlier in May. We all really enjoyed the conference, and so we're going to give you the highlights in a little bit of a conversation here. We recorded this discussion via Zoom call earlier this month due to the fact that we're all still working remotely. So I'd like to thank the participants, and with that, we'll get started.
Welcome back to the Technicast. Today, we're going to be doing another roundtable discussion. This time, it was about our recent virtual trip to the 2021 CSE annual meeting. That conference took place between May 3rd and May 5th, and it was for the Council of Science Editors. We've gone to this conference before in person, but this, I believe, was our first, maybe our second virtual conference. As part of that group contingent that went, we have Grace Taylor, Hayes Simpson, and Nathan Taylor, no relation. And so there were a lot of things that were discussed. We'll kind of just dive right into it. I thought one of the most interesting things about it, and it might just be because it's become so prescient here in the weeks following the conference, it was the keynote discussion on May 4th by Dr. Osterholm. It was very interesting just because it didn't really have a specific tie to publishing, although it covered issues with publishing. It was more just a discussion of the realities, current realities of COVID-19 in general, and the policies of sort of moving forward and how we're adapting to it. And it was just very interesting because he is a public health official, and or he is at least a public health scientist, and he discussed with sort of optimism how we were going to be, I think, moving forward with COVID, and how he was hopeful that we would be able to move forward and have in-person meetings and things like that, but that they did not know for sure when or how we would be able to move forward. And this was only just about a week and a half before we got word that mask mandates were going to be starting to be lifted, and that people who were fully vaccinated would be able to go out and start doing things, and that they didn't have to wear masks, and that we could lift certain restrictions. So I think it was interesting that even up until a few weeks before that announcement was being made, that we had scientists and officials that were not really sure how we were going to be moving forward, and that there are still a lot of people that are probably pushing for, while they're optimistic about us being able to resume sort of a normal life and normal schedule and being able to go to events here in the near future, that there is still some concern and some, maybe not, and apprehension about things, and that people should continue to be a little bit careful with what they're doing and things like that, which I think is very interesting, especially as there are more conferences and more events that we hope to see here in the near future later this year. And it'll be interesting to see if those happen with or without being virtual. And I think that in talking about COVID-19, it obviously was one of the biggest talking points of this conference in general. They talked a lot about the focus on preprints and preprint servers and how important they were, especially in the early stages of COVID-19, to get research out as quickly as possible. And I know they discussed a lot of people's fears with regard to preprints. Grace, I know you listened into that talk and had a little bit more information about it and ideas.
Yeah, I actually learned a lot more about preprints than I originally knew. Yeah, so there was kind of an explosion of preprint submissions and during the pandemic. And so this set off some alarms in the scientific publishing community, because they are not peer reviewed. So that one of the issues was that there would be early media coverage. So these manuscripts that are not peer reviewed would kind of be misconstrued as, you know, peer reviewed and published and by the media. So that was kind of one of the big issues. But one thing I did learn from the session was that there is some type of screening process. So they don't just go ahead and post these willy-nilly. So one of the things that they mentioned at the session was that they look out for things like conspiracy theories, which is a huge deal, as we know, especially with the COVID-19 pandemic and other political situations that we won't get into. But so I thought that was a really interesting discussion.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that they talked about a lot about fears that people had with regards to preprints spreading sort of misinformation, or maybe not even intentionally spreading it, unintentionally, if it was too early in research that they hadn't, if it hadn't been peer reviewed and hadn't been worked through. But I think they did a good job of talking about the fact that even though these articles or these preprints, however you want to call them, that they're going up onto these servers without being peer reviewed, but they are being screened fairly regularly. They are being updated when they usually do go through the peer review process, as many are sent through it. And that most scientists take a very cautionary look through them, that the bigger issue, of course, is it being picked up by mainstream media and non-scientific journals or magazines. I know they talked a little bit about National Geographic picking up certain information and running with it without it being peer reviewed, and people then kind of using that as a basis, even though it's not a peer reviewed scientific journal. And that they also talked about the fact that even though there was a great fear that we were going to see a lot of retractions, there really haven't been that many overall, that for the most part, most of the research that are in these, on these preprint servers have been fairly accurate and have ended up eventually going through various reviews and screening processes. So it's not as scary, I think, as, but it is an interesting step in the future of publishing that I think is going to continue to grow instead of shrink here after COVID-19.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And also one of the solutions they provided was to properly educate media outlets on how to properly cite preprints so that it's very clear that this is a preprint, it has not been peer reviewed, and also on the preprint server site to indicate that kind of like a cautionary note, please note that these have not been peer reviewed. So that's one of the, I guess, initiatives that they're trying to take.
Yeah, Nathan here. This is totally anecdotal, but I missed that session. But one of the things that I've noticed just from, you know, working in my own editorial offices is that the papers that are submitted to preprints are almost always accepted and like are well reviewed generally. So it's kind of an interesting, you know, I don't know, like it's not like that the, you know, the dregs of what's submitted is ever like ends up on preprints, I think. So that does bode well. Like I said, totally anecdotal, but still it kind of confirms what you were saying.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. I think there's just a fear, I think, among some people, especially in an era of conspiracy theories that get spread so very easily on social media. Not that we're going to indulge in too many of those, but that they do grow so quickly that something being picked up that hasn't been rigorously reviewed, as people would think, might lead to more of that. Hayes, I know you listened in on the panels about communication and scholarly publishing. So
yes, this is Hayes. And I'm actually picking up on where you guys left off about on the topic of preprint. That actually plays into a piece of the discussion about alternative ways to tell the story of science, the session that I attended, because it seems that we have entered the golden age of peer-to-peer communication amongst scientists. And one of the very important things for them to do right now is have a way to discuss preprints. And they've been doing that by utilizing all kinds of platforms that are available to them, one of them being Twitter. But since that isn't the best gatekeeper in the world, there are better options for discussion. And there was some talk about the importance of publishers providing those platforms. So one idea was that publishers could provide a forum for scientists to discuss preprints or whatever issues they want to discuss. The idea is that it's more increasingly important for science communities to be established. So more and more publishers are looking at ways to create those forums or to have newsletters or to offer blogs that invite guest scientists to write or to even do peer-to-peer interviews. One of the first speakers in the session, Charlotte Schubert, who's a science writer, talked about the evolution of blogs. Because at one point, not long ago, journals were the main gatekeepers of news and viewpoints, but that's shifted more so to the role of blogs right now. There are a number of blogs that have become popular as aggregators for newsletters and for science communities, such as she gave two important examples. One is the PLOS Blogs Network, and the other was Medscape. These are really important, they serve really important gatekeeper functions for communications amongst scientists. The other popular platform right now is newsletters. Newsletters don't necessarily look the way that they used to. They're a combination of social media and interviews and videos. So they're more interactive than they used to be. But with the rise of science newsletters, actually even Twitter is going to be releasing a newsletter feature soon. So that is a hot new platform.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting to just see how things that used to be older becoming more popular again. We've seen blogs have been around forever, newsletters have been around forever, but they're being used in new ways by different companies and different societies in order to kind of reach new audiences. Social media is growing. I mean, our company has its own blog that we use to try and share publishing news and information. We participate in other blogs that are similarly within our field. So it only makes sense that that is being extended into academic fields and scientific fields as well, and that they're going to be using that to try and attract new educators and new researchers in their field and attract more people to get interested in publishing and to spread the word about published articles and to sort of be able to market themselves in different ways, which I think is just shows how we are, especially here in the pandemic with things going virtual, just figuring out ways to go viral is sort of the key, I think, for being able to survive sort of as a publishing society and as a journal. Nathan, speaking of that, I know, Nathan, you participated in the EIC roundtable that was more specifically about publishing procedures and things like that. So if you had anything that you'd like to share.
Yeah, so it was really one of the most interesting panels that I attended at the conference. It was almost entirely focused on issues surrounding diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it was a really robust conversation featuring, you know, mostly EICs from across the spectrum of journals in terms of like discipline. And I'll just touch on a few of the main points the main takeaways that I kind of grasped from the session. And that's one is that like it was really encouraging to see just how seriously all the editors were taking these concerns, because it's clearly still a big issue in publishing, not only on the inside of like the editors, but also in editorial boards, reviewer pools, and in authors. You can see a lot of disparities there in various demographics. And all the editors were like extremely engaged and like ready and trying to do their best to address and come up with solutions for, tackling this challenge. One of the things that a lot of journals have begun doing is hiring or establishing a new editorial position in their journal, which is the DIE editor, which is an editor specifically focusing on issues surrounding diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI. Did I say DIE earlier? It's DEI. I think DIE would be a pretty bad acronym. So it's DEI editor. And one of the concerns that a lot of the editors were raising was just like, so what's this person supposed to do? We have this person now. They're a big part of our journal, but like, what are they actually doing that is like, anything more than just auditing our current like reviewer pools and our, editorial staff and things like that to make sure we get a diversity of voices in those places. So there was some discussion around that. And I think there weren't any like really clear cut answers. A lot of people were just like, yeah, I mean, we've had that issue too, where people are like, oh, well, what am I supposed to be doing now? You know, exactly. So they're still kind of like developing those protocols and things, and I can understand that. Another solution that a lot of some journals and some DEI editors have instituted at their journals was actually making a short like demographic survey for authors to fill out upon submission that included, full demographic information for the authors. And I think that it was a really fascinating discussion because all of the journals that had instituted this new protocol with the, submission of manuscripts, they started receiving a lot of pushback from authors, and rightly so, because a lot of authors were concerned that this information could actually be used to, just give information that would only bolster existing prejudices that exist in scholarly publishing and in, editorial, practices. So a lot of authors were concerned, like, I think I would prefer to just remain anonymous rather than having all of my demographic information available. So they were, receiving a lot of pushback. And it's just interesting to think about, how, the issue of diversity is like so multifaceted, and it's certainly not just isolated in the scholarly publishing field. The field itself is just like, attached to all other realms of society as it is, So I think a lot of the editors were just like, these are issues that we are really concerned about. We want to see them addressed. But we don't always know what we can do, And so there was a lot of discussion about that. I will say another really positive note too, is that a lot of the editors were talking extremely intersectionally around surrounding these issues of diversity. So I know I think gender disparity, for instance, wasn't like all that everyone was talking about. There was like a lot of discussion about how authors from like the global South, which are historically underrepresented in published research, can be amplified, their voices be amplified, because again, a lot of that's because there's such an extreme lack of funding for authors in the global South. So And that has nothing to do with like, you know, editorial policies at a journal. That's just like the kind of research that's being produced and where it's being produced. So, you know, if nothing else, the whole session just highlighted just how complex diversity is and how we can, you know, the challenges that we're faced in trying to, you know, address those issues are sometimes can backfire, like in the case of like the author demographic surveys that some of the journals were trying to introduce. So I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting just because no industry exists in a vacuum. So everything that's going on in the world right now, we see it a lot here in the United States, but it is interesting to see that it is a global issue, particularly with publishing and scientific publishing, that is a very global industry, to see how it's not just minorities within the United States, but there are global sort of minorities within the publishing community that are underrepresented, that they're working on. It's very complex. It's obviously not going to be something that happens overnight. And I think people need to understand that. It's nice to just see even simple changes. I know, I remember during the trivia night that Grace and I participated in, there was a question about how they have made updates to handbooks and style guides to capitalize certain words now, like black and white when referring to ethnicities, just to kind of make a finer point about racial disparities and things like that. And that there were other groups that believe indigenous was one of the other words that was now being capitalized as well. So it's just, there are sort of smaller changes like that that help to create more inclusivity, and then bigger, broader policies that are going to require more time and more effort. It's good to see that editors and journal publishers are thinking about this and working on it, and also asking people who are in these various minorities what they think, and making sure that this is something that reflects what they want, and it's not just sort of a policy that is ultimately going to, that has maybe good intentions, but will ultimately negatively affect them, that they are actually working towards that. So I think that is a really interesting takeaway from that, and that it's nice to see people moving forward, and it's nice to see companies sort of moving to improve that.
Yeah, to be honest, like I was kind of anticipating maybe hearing a few editorial or EIC voices that were like, you know, we need to focus more on the science and not on these issues. And I didn't hear any of that at all, actually. You know, all the editors were like in almost total agreement that this is something we all need to address. And, you know, but the common theme was sometimes we just don't know how or what the best way forward is. So I think that's still a progress. This is still something that's like being worked out in a lot of different journals. So, you know, more to come there for sure.
I think that's maybe the moral of the whole conference. There's more to come, and that it's sort of, let's give things some time and let's discuss things and figure out the best steps to move forward before jumping into anything. I think sort of with discussions of COVID-19, with discussions of new publishing platforms, new and preprints and things like that, it's just sort of seeing how they're going to progress and how people react to them. I think it was a really great conference. It was really great to be able to participate in it. It was my first year going to this one. I think it was everybody else's first time going. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was my first time.
Yeah. It was my first time as well.
So I think any other takeaways, anyone else, how they felt coming out of it, any sort of big takeaways. I think it was just a really well done. I think just like a lot of the other virtual conferences that we went to, the fact that they were able to adapt so well, make things very easily available to us, make things available after the fact is very helpful. We were able to listen in on panels that we might have missed otherwise if we were there in person. All of that's very helpful. It was a really good experience, I think, for Technica Editorial in general. And we're looking forward to being a part of future CSE annual meetings, whether they are in person or virtual. And we will be also taking part in other meetings later this year, and we will continue to provide the discussion that we have whenever we do that. I'd like to thank Grace and Hayes and Nathan. Thank you guys for joining us here and for talking about our experiences. That's the Technicast. Thanks.